Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hello, welcome to the last episode of The Rest is History of 2021. It's the 31st of December, and as we go through the 12 days of Christmas, Dominic, today we've got two dates from history, both of which are not exactly cheery, are they?
Well, it's every New Year's Eve, my thoughts naturally turn to Jean Bedel Bokassa, the leader of the Central African Republic, who later crowned himself emperor. Go on, Tom. What are you going to say?
Well, no. So we've got him, I'll save my choice.
Go on then. I shall talk about Bokassa. So some listeners may remember that we had Tom Owolade talking about post-colonial Africa, the sort of decolonization and then the independent rulers and so on. And Bokassa is one of the bad boys, I think it's fair to say.
He's the Caligula of...
He is a bit. Is Idi Amin the Nero?
Yes, I think so.
Is that your...
Idi Amin would be Nero.
Idi Amin is
Bokassa
more famous.
Would be Caligula.
I think Bokassa is the kind of connoisseur's choice.
The whole imperial stuff, the Napoleonic stuff. So there's a slight whiff of Napoleon in Egypt about this as well.
There absolutely is. So Bokassa, so let's put this into context. So the 31st of December 1965 is when he launches the coup that will take him to power and in the end to imperial greatness. But he begins life in 1921, 100 years ago. He's one of 12 children. Large families have been a theme of the 12 days of Christmas, because you may remember some of you that...
So is he Catholic?
I would say they probably are. Well, Catholicism is probably there because they're in a French colony.
Yeah.
So he's born to a village chief in a place called Bobangui, which is I'm reading from my notes, a large Mbaka village in the Lobe Basin.
Elaborate on that, Dominic.
Well, I don't actually know what that means.
Oh, don't you?
It's in the equatorial forest, it says here, in French Equatorial Africa. So basically in the heart of Africa.
The Central African Republic.
Right. But this is a very kind of... little known part of Africa. It's
Chad, right?
It's kind of bordered by Chad, South Sudan, sort of various other places. It's now the Central African Republic is one of the two poorest places really on the planet. I think this and Niger are the two places with some of the lowest living standards. So basically Bokassa, his father, he becomes orphaned quite young. I think his father was killed in a fight with some Frenchmen or something. And he joins the French army, which if you're a self-improving kind of person in Africa, is often what you do. It's what Idi Amin kind of did. You join the kind of colonial occupiers army and then you work your way up there. So he's a World War II veteran. He fights in France for the French. He actually fights his way into Germany. So this is the sort of side of the war hero side of him you don't often hear about. He carries on fighting for the French after World War II, and he fights with them in Indochina, in sort of Vietnam. And he's actually...
Dien Bien Phu, all that kind of stuff.
All that stuff, exactly. And he's actually given the Legion d'Honneur. So
is he?
The French think very highly of him. 1960, his colony, his homeland, becomes independent. It becomes basically the Central African Republic. And its first president is a man who happens to be his cousin, who is a man called David Dacko. So 2 years later, Bokassa leaves the French army and he comes back to the Central African Republic and he becomes...
So all this time he's been serving with the French army?
Well, serving with the French. He's always very close to the French. He becomes later very close to Valéry Giscard d'Estaing.
Yes, he does, yeah.
So he becomes the commander of the Central African army, basically because he's got all this experience. He's only got 500 soldiers. So it's a tiny, minuscule army in this very, very poor country. And he becomes the boss of the army. There are various reports that he insists on wearing all his medals, which annoys people. Mm-hmm. He wants to sort of show off how important he is. And he also always wants to sit next to his cousin at ceremonies. And other people don't think he should do this. He doesn't like this. There are increasingly heated arguments about where you sit at the president's table.
This is why you need a round table.
Well, it is. And Bokassa takes this terribly seriously. and is very put out that he doesn't get to sit next to his cousin. His cousin foolishly does not take it so seriously and thinks it's hilarious. Picasso,
a beginner's error.
Picasso. Get to 1965 and there's military coups in Africa, left, right, and centre, as the original kind of founding fathers of independence are displaced. Somebody says to Dacko, are you not worried that your cousin, who's so cross about the seating arrangements at dinner, is going to pull off a coup? And he says, no, Colonel Bokassa only wants to collect medals and he's too stupid to pull off a coup d'etat. Now, schoolboy
era. I mean, that is asking for trouble.
As soon as you say that, in Africa in the 1960s, the coup happens immediately afterwards.
They couldn't hit an elephant at this dist.
That's exactly what happens. So Bokassa decides, Dacko starts to build up his own presidential guard, and Bokassa thinks, right, it's now or never. You know, I've only got a few hundred men. So on the 31st of December 1965, he launches his coup. And Dacko, the president, is arrested and is taken to Bokassa. Bokassa very bizarrely hugs him and says, I tried to warn you, but now it's too late. So they don't kill him, though. They actually just put him in prison. And so it's by the standards, you know, Bokassa is not a monster because it's quite a bloodless coup. This sort of message goes out on the radio.
And is he kept alive?
He is kept alive. So because he becomes president again later on after Bokassa is gone. Yeah.
Oh, that's good news.
So Bokassa addresses the public on Radio Bangui. Do you want to hear his message, Tom?
I'd love to, yeah.
He says, Central Africans, this is Colonel Bokassa speaking to you. Since 3 o'clock this morning, your army is taking control of the government. The Dacko government has resigned. The hour of justice is at hand. The bourgeoisie is abolished. They don't really have a bourgeoisie in the Central African Republic.
So he's a communist, is he?
He's just spouting the stuff that people...
So this is French rather than Russian.
Yeah, well,
gibberish.
Interestingly, one thing, that the French are not displeased about the coup at all because...
Well, so Dacko, I was going to ask about that.
Because Dacko, so they love Bokassa because he's been in their army and he's their pal. Dacko had been cozying up to the Chinese, Tom. He'd been trying to encourage aid from China. The French
because
didn't like that at all.
The French are, I mean, they keep quite tight reins, don't they?
They do.
On their former colonies.
They absolutely do. What you can get from the Central African Republic, its biggest export is wood, but it also produces gold and diamonds and uranium. So
well, diamonds.
Yeah. Well, diamonds will come up. So Bokassa says the army will, you know, new era, all this tremendous. And he's a bit of a modernizer at first. So often some of these people who you think of as tremendous villains have these other sides to them. So do you want to hear about his modernizing?
I'd love to.
Band begging.
I mean, I'd rather hear about the mad stuff.
Tom-tom playing, only allowed in evenings and at weekends.
Okay.
So you try to play a tom-tom at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday in the afternoon, no good.
Arrested.
Polygamy is banned. Okay. Female circumcision is banned.
Okay,
he opens a public transport system with 3 bus lines.
Okay, good.
That's not bad. And a ferry system. And subsidizes 2 new national orchestras.
Well, this is wonderful stuff. However,
there's a downside. He does carve up his finance minister with a razor after a disagreement about the budget in 1968. So that's a low, I think.
Well, we can think of a number of prime ministers who would.
Yeah. Margaret Thatcher and Nigel Lawson. Or Tony, of course.
Tony and Gordon. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Boris and Rishi.
If Tony had only taken after...
Did he literally do that? Or is that a slander?
Some people say the finance minister was hanged or some other fate awaited him. But there was definitely a disagreement about the budget and there was definitely violence.
There are rumours that he engaged in cannibalism.
Well, we're going to come to this.
Right. Okay,
so in traditional fashion, time goes on and he becomes more and more hubristic. And on the 4th of December 1977, he crowns himself Emperor of Central Africa. And he basically has this massive coronation modelled on the coronation.
It's a brilliant throne in the shape of an eagle, doesn't he?
It looks absolutely...
Do you know, I've always thought, every time I've looked at that, I thought if I became, you know, if I staged a coup and I became leader of a country, that's exactly what I'd do.
I think if you have a coup, to my mind, there are 2 reputable ways to go. So one is to be like Antonio Salazar, who was the economist who became dictator of Portugal.
Yeah.
And he was very austere and I think you could do that and keep some degree of credibility. You could say, I'm just very professorial. know, I'm the father of the nation, all that.
Or you go the full Caligula.
Or you go the full, I'll have a throne like an eagle. I'll give diamonds to people.
Yeah.
I'll just go completely mad. So his coronation cost a third of his country's annual budget. So basically, it also cost, interestingly, the exact amount of money, of aid money that the French gave them every year. He spent the whole lot on his coronation, which is modelled on Napoleon's coronation.
Which, in a way, the French, I mean, must have felt flattered by.
Well, they were feeling very flattered because he was giving President Giscard diamonds.
Yeah.
Which later would come back to bite Giscard and cost him, some people say, cost him the 1981 French presidential election, because this was absolutely scandalous that he was basically accepting diamonds from this African emperor. So
even the French found that shocking.
Well, they didn't find it as shocking as we would. I mean, they thought it was perhaps slightly overstepping the mark.
Okay.
But he's kicked out in a coup in 1979, and Dacko comes back. And Dacko gives evidence at Bokassa's trial and says, I've seen butchered bodies in the sort of cold storage rooms of Bokassa's palace, and Bokassa would snack on them. Bokassa's security chief testified that he had personally cooked human flesh and served it to Bokassa on an occasional basis. There were rumours, Tom, that Bokassa had served his enemies to Giscard and other visiting Frenchmen. Mm. Now, we know that the French have interesting, you know, they'll eat horse,
they eat
snails.
Horse, don't they? Yeah.
So whether they eat, like, former Central African Republican finance ministers.
But I thought these were not true. These rumours were not true.
I think they're probably not true. What actually does for Bokassa?
Idi Amin did, right?
No, Idi Amin didn't.
That wasn't true either.
I think that's made up.
Okay.
I think these are all slightly sort of distasteful, slightly racist rumours, aren't they?
But they're originating within African discourse.
Yeah, themselves, I suppose so, yes. But what Bokassa had done, he had done a terrible thing, actually, Tom. So listen to this. So what caused the coup is that at the beginning of 1979, he passed a law that all high school students should wear a uniform made in a factory owned by one of his wives. It's basically to enrich his wife. And when the students didn't like this at all, you know, we're talking about sixth formers and stuff.
Were they nice uniforms or?
No, I think they were terrible.
They're terrible, okay.
They're probably very scratchy or something. They threw stones at his car and he was very put out by it, including lots of kids threw stones at his car. He was absolutely outraged by this. He ordered his men to round up loads of children and kill them.
And that's
killed about
true, 100 is it?
People,
that's,
yeah. Killed about 100 kids.
Do you know what's amazing about this, the 12 Days of Christmas, is that we've chosen these. I mean, certainly I didn't think about the various ramifications, but we've had a massacre of innocents, and now we've got another massacre of innocents.
This happens a lot in history, I suppose.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So the French eventually pulled the plug. They thought he was embarrassment and that was enough. So in the end of 79, they got rid of him. But he wasn't executed or anything. I think he just sort of lingered on, died in prison or something like that, or died in exile.
He didn't go to France, hang out with Giscard.
Should we do some live research?
Yeah, do some live research.
We haven't done some live research for a while. Here we go. He dies in 1996.
Yeah, that's quite late.
So he was tried, yes. I knew he'd been tried in the Central African Republic on treason, murder. He was found cleared of cannibalism, found guilty of the murder of school children. He was sentenced to death, but it was commuted to life in solitary confinement. But then he was pardoned and released in 1993, and he lived a private life in Bangui and died in 1996. So he had seven. We're talking about people with a lot of children. He had 17 wives and 50 children.
Goodness.
Yeah, that's a lot of. That's a lot.
A lot of Christmas presents.
Yeah, there's a nice Christmas theme to end our discussion of the Emperor Bokassa.
Well, I thought that was fascinating.
Okay, what's next? Well, we'll find out after the break. What excitement? What drama? All right, we'll see you after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. The tension has been mounting as we've been waiting to find what Tom has chosen as his New Year's Eve happy celebratory moment. Tom, what is it?
It's another killer. It's killed more than Picasso. It's killed more than Herod. It's killed more than the US Army at Wounded Knee. It's coronavirus. It's COVID because it was on this day 2 years ago, 2019,
yeah,
that the World Health Organization was first informed of there being cases of viral pneumonia in Wuhan. I thought that this would be a suitably jolly note on which to end the series of podcasts that we've done this year, because probably without COVID, we wouldn't have started doing the podcast. In a way, I mean, you know, we've been shaped by it, but we haven't talked about COVID at all as a historical phenomenon. What kind of whether it will be remembered by the history books, whether it will be forgotten, like Spanish flu famously has been forgotten. So I don't know what your views are on that, Dominic, whether you think that this will be remembered as a kind of seismic global event or whether it will fade and pass away.
It's really hard to say, Tom. I think Spanish flu is a very good example, because Spanish flu, I remember reviewing a book about the Spanish flu about 3 or 4 years ago, called Pale Rider by Laura Spinney. A brilliant book, actually. Really interesting book. And what struck me then was the Spanish flu famously killed more people than World War One. It had a colossal...
And it kept coming back in waves.
I think there were four waves of the Spanish flu in about 2 or 3 years. So Spanish flu famously, not Spanish. People think it was
American,
Spanish.
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. People think America? Probably started, actually. I mean, I've seen things saying it maybe it started on kind of pig farms in Kansas.
Yeah,
that it was taken by American soldiers to the great troop camp at Etaples in France, and they're spread among the Allied soldiers and then spread and spread and spread. So it's definitely a contributing factor to the collapse of the German army at the end of 1918, and then spreads throughout the world, kills more people than the First World War. You know, there are places have lockdowns, places have all kinds of different measures to kind of cope with
it. Well, the whole thing about the lockdowns, there were famous case examples of cities that did lock down and suffered far fewer casualties than cities that didn't. And those were hugely informative on the readiness of governments to impose lockdowns this time round.
Yeah, although the results of Spanish flu kind of lockdowns and measures were kind of mixed. So, for example, some places closed their schools. But I think in New York, if I'm remembering correctly, and apologies if I have misremembered, but I think in New York... The health people insisted on keeping the schools open because they said there we can observe the children and we'll be able to step in and act. And if we, you know...
Were children more at risk from Spanish flu?
Well, children were much more at risk. I mean,
that was the kind of hideous twist, wasn't it? That it was the young that were targeted by it rather than the old.
Yes, exactly. That's why it rips through the armies in the First World War. And then, of course, through kids, exactly. So lots of families would have lost a child or known people who'd lost a child. And obviously that's what I think in terms of the sort of almost the imaginative impact, that's the big difference between the Spanish flu and COVID, is that COVID is not a disease. So children have, as far as we know, touched
and also
so far, been immune.
That I suppose the impact of Spanish flu was blunted by the fact that the First World War had gone on before. which was a visual display of destruction. The impact of COVID, I imagine, for future historians will be aggravated by the fact that it hit a globalized era of peace.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
You know, because it's frontiers being closed, flights being cancelled, great cities falling silent. That is shocking because up until that point, everything had been so interconnected, and it's those interconnections that actually enabled COVID to spread as fast as it did.
I mean, the weird thing about Spanish flu is it leaves so little impact on popular memory. So, you know, if anyone's ever studied the 1910s and 1920s at school, you know, you'd spend weeks and weeks and weeks on the First World War, months, and then it's sort of, oh, the Spanish flu also happened. Now let's move on to the Roaring Twenties.
Well, we're going to be doing 1922, aren't we? I think is that going to be our first
one of our first
standalone podcast of the new year, so anniversary, obviously. And that's the year in which The Wasteland is published. And actually, when you read The Wasteland, you do notice its presence in a way that I hadn't done.
The people sweeping over London, London Bridge.
Kind of people coughing.
Yeah.
This kind of sickness. It's a kind of lurgy. Yeah, it's there on the yellow fog. So perhaps people will look back at the works of literature, the works of art,
But nobody talked about the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the Spanish flu was gone as a subject of conversation, wasn't it? I mean, people.
Right. So I reckon people will remember this. I think it will be remembered as a kind of seismic historical event for two reasons.
Go on.
The first is that the world was, you know, just saying, has been so much more interconnected than it was in the early 1920s.
Yeah.
And so the effect of lockdowns, of governments putting up national barriers, seismically much, much greater.
Yeah.
And people have been able to have lockdowns to the degree that they've been able to because of the improvement in technology.
Yeah.
You simply couldn't, you know, you couldn't do Zoom in 1920.
No, of course.
So people just had to carry on. And, you know, quite a lot of people can die in the background without the mass of society noticing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of the grim truth of it. You know, every year we have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people die of flu. And it barely registers. So the fact that you have all this amazing footage of the great, you know, the great streets of the great cities going silent. I mean, that's there. It's recorded. People will look at it and they will serve as very, very powerful visual signifiers of what happened. And I think the other reason, and I think this is still very much open, what the impact would be, is that China behaved disgracefully over the early months. And I think that a question that was seen as very much a kind of crankish, Piers Corbyn-esque perspective a year ago, the idea that it had been, perhaps a leak from the laboratory at Wuhan, I think is now, it's more broadly accepted as certainly a possibility. I don't think the truth will ever be known. But I think that has measurably darkened international perspectives on China over the past year. I think that globally, people are a lot more suspicious of China than they were.
I think that's possibly true. Also coincides, of course, with the Chinese crackdown on the Uyghurs, doesn't it? So,
I think it's expressive of that.
And Hong Kong. So there's sort of a series of things at once. I think what will make it remembered is probably the government response to it rather than COVID itself. So, because the government response to it has obviously been, when I say intrusive, I mean, it's obviously literally been intrusive in the sense that it has forced you to stay at home. You have the app, you have test and trace, you have all these things which obviously didn't really exist in the 1920s. It's obviously had an economic impact because of lockdowns. So I think it's been a catalyst. It's accelerated changes that were already underway, the death of the
development streets, of podcasts, for instance.
The development of podcasts is actually an example of that, though, isn't it? This is the decline of traditional media and the rise of new media. The move to online shopping and so on, the development of the digital economy, all those kinds of things. I mean, they've been speeded up by COVID. They would have happened anyway, but more slowly, I think. But also, I suppose there's an argument. I don't want to sound like a paranoid lunatic, but there's an argument.
Go on, sound like a paranoid.
No, I don't. I won't sound like a paranoid lunatic.
Go on.
Obviously, you know, if you live in a world where you're showing your vaccine passport, where you a sort of biosecurity age. I mean, that may well be the future. You know, we may all have...
Well, we don't know, do we? We don't know. It's too early to say.
But it's completely plausible, Tom, that in the year 2080, on your phone, if phones still exist, you will have a record of all your vaccinations. Yeah. And you will need to show these things to get into various places, especially if there are more pandemics. So in that sense, since COVID, because of the role of government.
Yeah, the infrastructure's been set up for that.
The infrastructure is ready, but also the role of government more generally, furlough, taking on massive debt. I mean, those are going to be issues for the rest of our lives, actually.
So happy new year, everyone. Ho, ho, ho. We've recorded, we've done, what, 6 episodes now in a block.
Of the 12 days of Christmas.
And this was meant to be a kind of cheery,
knockabout.
It hasn't really, has it? I mean, some of them have, but...
But you've made... Well, you've chosen...
Well, I know. What was I thinking?
Yeah. So we've got some much more cheery ones for the next few episodes of this particular series, haven't we? We've got births and... Well, we've got some deaths, but we've got births.
We've got two calamities hitting the Roman Empire at various stages.
But we've got, I think it's quite nice because we get to draw parallels between events that we wouldn't otherwise do. Anyway, we should say goodbye and wish you a happy new year.
Very happy new year. And we will see you in 2022.
I.e. tomorrow. with the next edition of the 12 or 13 days of Christmas. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.